The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Good morning. My name is Nathan. I'm one of the pastors on the team. It's really great to be here with you this morning. Driving through the country with the family. My sweet family is here. Always makes me really happy. We did something a little bit different since gas costs $17 a gallon now. We all drove together, and now I know how I can ask you to pray for my wife as she drives every day with four kids in the car. It's a real thing. Anyway, we are continuing in our series in the book of Ecclesiastes. Some of you are like, again, we're still here. We're just talking about depressing. Yeah, we're still here, but don't worry. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. We got 2 weeks left before we jump into our redemption series. I'm very thrilled with this. By 2 weeks, I mean through. If you count today, it's three. I don't know how you count weeks. So it's 2 or 3 weeks, depending on if you count today. Anyway, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and 8, and I've got a little bit of a disclaimer. We're covering a lot of content today. And so if you're like, Nathan, you skipped a verse, it's not because I didn't like that verse. It's because there's two chapters. And I love these two chapters because there's one holistic thought that is Paul didn't write Ecclesiastes. The Solomon or Koheleth or the teacher is beginning to land the plane now. It's one of those things if you've ever flown. And they give the warning like an hour before the landing of like, if you're flying to Atlanta, you arrive, you get up there, and they're like, all right, so now we're beginning our descent. And you're like, we still have 30 minutes left. I don't understand. How far up are we? That's what's going on, all right? We're in chapter 7. He's beginning to land the plane with this one holistic idea. And as I was preparing for this conversation, as I was reading in this text, I was remembering with great fondness last summer, oh so long ago, where we got to take our kids tubing for their first time. It was the first time they'd ever been tubing. And I, as a father, was introduced to the great sport of how fast can I throw my kids off the tube. And those of you that have ever driven a boat, there's this really great privilege where you're like, I think it speaks more to my brokenness as a human being, where it's like, all right, so I see them, they're holding on for dear life, and now we're going to turn this way, and then we're going to flip back, and they're just going to go tumbling, and they are going to be absolutely thrown. And that is the great competition, in essence, between fathers and their children. How can I throw you off? And this is what's really great, though, like, because then I get on the tube, and then it's my brother's turn to drive, and it's the same thing. And it's this feeling of, can I hold on to these handles enough and have enough stability so that whatever is coming, because I know you're trying to throw me, I can maintain my grip on this one single thing that is keeping me into the great depths of the lake. And that is kind of what's going on in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Because this is, life is chaos. Like, I feel like there's this understanding. When I was a kid, I was like, my parents understand life. Like, there's people and there's experts and there's the powers that be. Like, this is order, and I just kind of get to live in the order. And now the older I'm going, I'm like, no, like, it's just chaos. There is randomness. And in these two chapters, Paul did not write Ecclesiastes. He wasn't around. What the author of Ecclesiastes, what the teacher is doing is he is hammering down on one of the three major themes that he is just crushing. And this is what I mean. At the beginning of Ecclesiastes, what he speaks to is he says, listen, life is meaningless. Life is hebel. Life is a vapor. You are nothing. And you're like, thanks, I appreciate that. And you're like, no. So the first big idea is life is nothing because in the grand context of the cosmos, they have been around for a really long time. And they're going to be around a long time after you die. And speaking to like just the absolute brevity of life when you put it in context to the everything else that is in nature. And you're like, we're really, really small. So really, in the context of your life, what are you? And you're like, thanks. Thanks, Solomon, not Paul. And then you're like, all right, so he moves on from that great transition, and he says, here's the second thing. The brevity of your life, you are going to die. So it's not just the great cosmos are way, way bigger than you and you can't control it and you can't touch it. It's also like you're going to die. In fact, your life, you're gonna live, and no matter what you do, no matter how great you are, your life ends with a funeral. The mortality of the human race is around 100%. Like, no matter what you do, no matter how great you are, no matter how evil you are, no matter how successful you are, or no how much, however much you feel like your life is a failure in your diary, you're like, you're gonna die. So does it really matter? Your life is a vapor, it is a mist that is rising up from a field that is going to be burned up once that 90-degree weather hits. And you're like, yeah, that's real encouraging. I'm really glad I came to church this morning. And this morning, he's speaking to this third big idea in chapter 7 and 8. Because this is, and what he's speaking to is against this mantra that you and I, we cling to like a tube, like holding on to that inner tube, pulling behind the boat. He's like, this isn't going to work out. This is not going to work out well for you. And you're like, all right, so what is it? Here we go. Ready? Chapter 7. He begins off chapter 7 with some real interesting things. Here we go. Ready? Verse 1. A good name is better than precious ointment. And you're like, I can get on board with that. That's true. And the day of death is better than the day of birth. Okay, sure. It's better to go into the house of mourning, is it? Than to go into a house of feasting. And I listened to Solomon, and I'm like, really though? Like, I don't know if you, funerals aren't great. And this is what he's doing. Hold on, I want you to catch this. Because you listen to the front end, and you're like, I kind of prefer A. And he's like, nope, B is better. And you're like, huh. Watch this, he does the same thing. Sorrow is better than laughter. If I had to choose, I would choose to not be sad. He's like, nope, sorrow is better. Why? For by the sadness of the face, the heart is made glad. And you're like, man, that's actually really true. Like, I remember watching Wonder, like, just ugly crying. And then, like, there's this really sweet joy. If you haven't seen Wonder, don't watch it. If you don't like to cry, don't watch Wonder. Anyway, but, like, we've all been there in those moments in our lives where we're really, really sad, where we're doing the weeping thing, and then there's this really sweet laughter that takes place. And this is what he is doing, is he is beginning to subvert the expectations. The path of wisdom that you and I expect is, the path of wisdom is not what you and I would necessarily anticipate it to be. Does that make sense? Like, we tend to think that the better life is the one lived in the house of feasting. The better life is the one where you're celebrating birth. And the better life is the one where you're not in the presence of death. And Solomon is like, yeah. But consider this. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. And you're like, man, that's really true. The way in which that is the right way to walk in this path of life in a difficult and complex world is not always what you would expect. And so maybe the right path is something that you and I did not necessarily anticipate. And we're like, man, this is really true. The path of wisdom really is oftentimes the one that subverts my expectations. And then he's setting us up, and he's like, yeah, you don't expect the right path. You don't expect the right path. And then he does the real twist. Are you ready? Look at verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. And you're like, yeah, I've been tracking with Ecclesiastes. Wisdom's really, really important. I need to cling to wisdom. I need to find wisdom. I need to grab it. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. Amen? No amens. Okay. And the advantage of knowledge is the wisdom that preserves the life of him who has it. And you're like, yeah, that's really true, Solomon. Wisdom really is the way to go. Like, I need to find wisdom. I need to grasp it. I need to cling to it. And then he ends with this. This is where you hit, you flip around, you hit the wake. Ready? Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? It's like a joke. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? And I love this, because if you're paying attention, this is what's going on. Solomon's like, listen, you got to do this because you don't expect this, and this is really what wisdom is. But also at the end of the day, God's made this world really jacked up, so good luck. And you're like, but wait, I thought you had all these really wise proverbs, and now you're like, there's no hope. Like, the world's really crooked, you can't fix it. And you're like, man, you sound like a news 24-hour news commentary. Like, there's no hope. And you're these,
It doesn't get better, y'all. Verse 14, ready? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. For in the day of adversity, consider God has made one as well as the other. Thanks. So that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Okay, all right. Where are you going with this here, teacher? In my vain life, I've seen everything. In my quick, brief, passing life, I've seen a lot of things. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. This is great. You know those verses in the Bible where you're like, what do I even do with that verse in the Bible? Verse 16, don't be overly righteous and don't make yourself too wise. Solomon, you literally just said, walk the path of righteousness. And now you're like, doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Being good doesn't matter. Being wise doesn't matter. And I'm like, don't let my kids read these verses, right? Like some of you are sitting with your kids, you're like, close your ears on this part. Like this isn't good. What do we do with this? Don't be overly wicked. Don't be a fool. Why would you die before your time? It's good that you should take hold of this. And from that, withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out of both of them. And you're like, I don't even know what is happening here. Why are these verses in the Bible? That doesn't sound like maybe that's an addendum. Tell me that's an addendum someone added late. It's not. And you're like, what's happening? What is he pressing against? This idea. Solomon is deconstructing the idea that if you're wise enough and you're good enough, you're going to be successful in life. If you grew up in Buckle of the Bible Belt, chances are, like me, the lessons oftentimes we take and we pick up from mom and dad, from Sunday school teachers, from teachers, and from the neighbors and the parents and the aunts and the uncles and the grandparents is if you're a good little boy and girl, you're going to have a great life. And when you don't have a great life, what's the problem? You're not a good little boy and girl. And so if you want the American dream, white picket fence, 2.5 kids, what do you have to do? You have to work hard. You have to be responsible. Invest your money. Go to the right school. And then that equals success. And what Solomon is saying is that is not true. You can be as good as you can be, and you can walk the wisest path, and it can all still fall apart, right? The whole idea, this whole mantra that is oftentimes, I think, the ethos of the American dream, like it's just an illusion. Life is not a cosmic vending machine where if you punch the right buttons and you put in the right equations, you get the life you want. It's like, because we've all been there. Like, if we're honest with ourselves, we've been there. Like, I've been in the relationship where I feel like I made no mistakes, and then it still went sideways. Or I've been in the job, or I've been in the relational thing where it's really, really complicated, and I feel like there's no right answers, but I feel like I did a pretty good job, and then it just plummeted. And I got burned real bad. Like, what do I do with that? And Solomon's like, this is the human experience. And you're like, man, we've been there. And this is what's deceptive. What's deceptive, though, is still that call, that song that plays in the back of our minds where it says, yeah, but you just, maybe next time if you do a little bit better. Maybe this time if you just figure out the answer, you'll get it right. This week, I filled out my bracket, my March Madness bracket. Any other March Madness people? Okay, there's a few of you. All right, good. I'm going to let you know a little secret. You probably already know if you've heard me preach before. I'm not a sports guy. I am not, like, at all. Like, so, like, even last night I was talking to someone who knows me, and they're like, so who do you have going all the way? I'm like, the Tar Heels, because they're my team. And they're like, by your team, what do you mean? I'm like, I like them when I was 8. that's it. That's my team. I pull for them more than any other team. And he said, that's a really low bar. I'm like, well, that's fair. That's fair. It's still my team. But this is what I did. Every year, our staff team, we pull together and we do a bracket, and the winner gets a hat. That's our great big thing. And so every year I choose a different path, and I try it. One year I just, like, whoever the ranks are, like, I'm assuming these people are the experts, so I just choose the higher rank, and their person's going to win. And when she gets to the Final Four and all the one rank one teams, I have no idea. And so I tried that. I tried a couple other things this year. Don't tell Jim Geyer this. He's kind of he's the basketball nerd on the team. And I don't tell him this, because every year I always come in last place, without a doubt, without fail. And so this year I was like, I'm going to fix it. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get the right answer. And I did some research, and I said, what commentator has the statistically best bracket over the last 10 years? And I copied and pasted his. And I found it. It wasn't the top dude. The top dude, the dude that got it the closest last year, he didn't make it public this year. But there's another guy, I think he was like third. And I copied and pasted his, except I made one change. He had North Carolina lose the first round, and I had them going all the way. And right now, I am doing better than that guy. And so it's really, really killing it. And Jim Geyer has no idea. But this is the insanity. You can look at the most reliable source of wisdom, and you can still get it wrong. And some of you are like, I'm there. I feel like we all have our thing, right? I feel like with my job, my finances, my career path, my marriage, my kids, my crazy neighbor, the person in the life group I don't know what to do with, you're like, I feel like I'm trying real hard. And I'm lost. I'm just losing. I still don't know. Friends, brothers and sisters, what is the thing right now where if you were to review the last few thoughts when you put your head on the pillow last night, what's the thing that's causing you anxiety? The complexity and the frustration you have at figuring out your life, the weight and the the weight of the feeling like you've got to thread that needle, or your whole life is going to be ruined. Like that mindset is just poison, and it's going to crush you. The whole anthem that we hear sung throughout our lives, and man, especially in this moment, is you live your life. You find out your dream. You find out your passion. You find out your college. You find out the best you. And then you go and pursue that, and you go realize that. You actualize that. And then you're going to be really, really happy. That is a lie. Like, shoot that dream. This is what the teacher is doing. Is he's like, you can't figure it out. And in a world where it is autonomy and independence and pull yourself up by your bootstraps because we're good old Southern boys and girls, like, we got this. Solomon's like, you don't. And it finds out like it eats us alive. There is such profound pressure to figure it out. Like, do you remember being in high school? Yes. And being a high school student in like 10th, 11th, 12th grade year, and you're like, what do you want to do with your life? And they're like, I have no idea. I have a daughter who's 10, and we were driving, and she was real quiet. I'm like, hey, what's going on? She's like, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And I'm like, you're 10! Like, it doesn't matter. And I'm like, but she's like, no, Dad, I need to figure it out. I'm like, you don't. And, like, you have this pressure when you're in high school of, like, I got to figure out what school to go to. And then you get to school. You get to the college. And you're like, I got to figure out my major. And then I got to figure out who I'm going to marry. Like, those are the two things I've got to figure out. And then you're like, I don't know what to do. And then you get married, or then you graduate school. And you're like, I got to find the right career path. I got to figure out if I actually want to do what I spent $100,000 to figure out how to do. And then, like, I got to find this person. And if you didn't find the person in college, then you have to figure out the person now. And then if you do get married, then you start having kids, and you're like, now I got to figure out how to love this spouse that I've committed the rest of my life to. I don't know if I made a terrible mistake. And then you start having kids, and you're like, now I got to figure out my kids. And it's like, I don't know, I'm just going to break them. And I can't cause them the same trauma that I had with my childhood. And it's just incredibly stressful. I got to figure it out. I got to read the right books. And then you get to 38, 40, and you're like, oh yeah, retirement. I got to figure that out. And it's just All the money I invested last year is gone. And you're like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just going to be working until I'm literally in the coffin. And you're just like, life is just one problem that the world looks at us and is like, you've got to figure this out. And you're like, I can't even figure myself out. It's a lot. And what Solomon is saying is, that's right. What Solomon is getting at here is that there's always going to be a gap between what we want to know, what we know, and the impact that knowledge will have on life. Here we go. Ready? Verse 20, 23. All of this I've tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? Yeah. Our wisdom's insufficient. And so then Solomon's like, well, maybe the teacher, he turns around. He's like, well, maybe other people. Maybe I'll look around and I'll find what other people are doing. And then he does two things. One, he looks to the most appealing feminine voice. The loudest feminine voice. And then he looks at the loudest masculine voice that are standing on the street corners. And he's like, how does this turn out? And so this is what he says. Verse 25, I turned in my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know wickedness and folly and foolishness that is madness. And I found something more bitter than death. The woman whose heart snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Whew. You're like, man, it's like Solomon had a bad experience with women or something. And then you're like, well, he had 1,000 wives. And so he really tried. He tried real hard. And this is what he found. He says this, verse 28, my soul has sought repeatedly. I have not found one thing I've sought repeatedly. I haven't found one righteous man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among all of these I have not found. And you're like, that's really rough, Solomon. And you're like, he's not a trustworthy voice when it comes to the female. Like, let's just be really, really honest. And this is what he does. He's like, listen, I have looked to the most appealing voice of women, and it only leads to destruction. And you're like, that's really depressing and a little bit misogynistic there, Solomon. And you're like, yeah, it is. And then he does this. Verse 2. Then I said, keep the king's command. All right, so maybe the most beautiful and appealing voice of women. Maybe that'll save me. Nope. What about the voice of power? The most masculine, the most powerful, the guy that's in charge, he's standing in front, he's the king. Just listen to him. Maybe that'll save you. Look at what he says. Look at his conclusion here. Verse 7. The king does not know what is to be, for who can tell him how it will be? No man, even the king, has the power to retain the spirit or the power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war. There's no escape from war. Nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All of this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man has power over man to his hurt. Listen, in my own, left to myself, I can't figure out the answer. I can't nail it down. But then when I look to the left and to the right, the voices of the men and the women in my life, they can't figure it out. In fact, verse 29 of chapter 7 really sums up what he is going for here. He says, see, this alone I have found. God has made man upright, but they've sought out many schemes. So this is the really depressing point, my friends. Even you don't have the answers to your life. People around you, they also try as they might to convince you otherwise. No one does. The answers and the expectations that we have and the hopes that we have, even the king, doesn't have anything. Look at, he keeps going. And now you can feel in the tone of the author, he's getting more desperate to find answers. Because then he says this, when he gets to 8 verse 10, he's like, well, what about the path of the wicked? Maybe if I just give up, Like, what if I just surrender and be like, you know what? It doesn't matter. I'm just going to go live my life. And some of us were like, we tried that. Didn't go well. That's kind of what he says, verse 10. Then I saw the wicked buried. Okay. They used to go in and come out of the holy place, and they were praised in the city where they had done such things. And this is also vanity. This is meaningless. Because the sentence against the evil deed was not executed speedily, and the heart of children is man is fully set to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe I just go the path of evil. Yet I know that it will be well those with who fear God, because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked. Neither will he prolong his days like a shadow, because he did not fear before God. Now, there's a little breadcrumb there, but I want to get his point. He's like, listen, giving up on wisdom and giving up on righteousness also doesn't, I don't think that's the answer, because he's like, because you're going to stand before God, and that seems like a really terrifying thing. And he's like, so maybe the path of righteousness. Like, if wickedness is really, really bad, maybe the righteous path. So maybe I just need to be really, really good. Verse 14. Sorry, guys. There is vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. And you guys have all been in that classroom, right? Where you're like, I was a really good kid. I was trying to do my homework, and I got in trouble. And then also you're like, there's a kid that does really, really bad stuff, and he got the award. And you're like, what do I do with this? That's the teacher's point. In conclusion, my friends, absolute nihilism. Here we go. Verse 16. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, and how neither day nor night does one eye see sleep. And then I saw all the works of God, that man can't find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in his seeking, he won't find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find out. All right, have a great week. Okay, what do we do with this? What is he doing? Like, where is there any hope in this? Because I feel like he's just taking what so much of us have imbibed over the years, and the ethos and the culture of you just work real hard and then you are responsible for what you have, because we all know God helps them, those who help themselves, and then you're just going to be really, really happy, wealthy, and wise. And you're like, Solomon just feels like he's just beating that idea to death. Yes. That's exactly what he's doing. And you're like, why? Like, where is there hope in this? I grew up on a dairy farm. When I was in college, we had some friends come over, and they were hopped up on Christian beer. That's Mountain Dew, for those of you that don't know. And we were, it was really late at night, and they got it in their minds, we're going to go cow tipping, because we were dairy farmers. We had beef cows right next to us. And they're like, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We should go out cow tipping. We're going to knock them over. It's going to be real great. And they're like, they went up to my dad, and they're like, can we do this? Like, are you okay with this? And my dad's like, yeah, it's fine. Go for it. And I'm talking with them. We're at the kitchen table, and they're about to go out, and they're like, do you want to come? I'm like, no, I don't want to come. Like, there's electric fences out there. There's manure everywhere. It's midnight, and there's a bull out there. And they're like, we'll be fine. And I'm like, also, side note, I was like, I don't think cow tipping's a thing. And they're like, it's definitely a thing. I'm like, no, I grew up on a farm. I know things. I know a couple things. I don't know a lot of things, but I do know cows, you can't tip it over. And they're like, well, we've seen it on TV. And I'm like, yeah, but that's that's TV. Cows, they weigh hundreds, if not thousands of pounds. Also, they don't sleep on their feet. Like, that's horses. Horses are ridiculous, right? But no, I'm sorry, dairy farmer prejudice here. And you're like, but this is, they don't do this. And also, they run away. They're very scared animals. And also, our beef cows are kind of wild. And they're like, nope, we're going to go do this. And this is what's crazy, is they left. And my dad, I was like, Dad, are you worried? He's like, no. The bull is, I'm a little bit worried about them. And this is the thing. The most loving thing to do for my friends is try to kill this dream that cow tipping is real. And it was the best thing for them, for their good. Because, again, to reiterate, electric fences and bulls and cow manure at midnight is a really bad trifecta. And they didn't listen. Sometimes the most loving thing we can do for one another is to destroy the lie. Because to pursue after a thing that you think you can arrive at on your own risks a path and a cost that will destroy you. And we have this, and still the enemy brings up, yeah, but if you can just figure it out, if I can just figure it out, if I can figure out why this person, my spouse, is doing this, if I could just figure out what to say. And the enemy loves to spiral the brain where you start having the practice conversations. You know the practice conversations where you start having your brain and you start pre-arguing before they even say it. And you're like, I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to figure out the right text chain in which to have with them, and that will arrive at the answer I want. And the enemy's like, yeah, you could do that. And he's like, you can't. It's bigger than you. You can't figure it out. There's no Twitter feed. There's no commentator. There's no influencer, pastor, or counselor that has figured it out. Let the dream die. Wisdom, so please don't hear what I'm not saying. Wisdom has value. Wisdom won't save you. Doing the right thing matters, but your well-being is not contingent on you doing the right thing. Doing the right thing is not going to fix this world. It's bigger than you. And you're like, so what do we do? There's breadcrumbs. Look back at chapter 7, verse 18. He says this. He says, it's good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come from both of them. Flip over to chapter 8, verses 12 and 13. There's the breadcrumb again. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know it will be well with the one who really, really is wise. No, for the one who fears God, because they fear before him. Look at chapter 9, verse 1. Dipping a little bit ahead, but this wraps up his holistic idea real well. But all of this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hands of God. Why does it keep going back to the fear of God? Like all of Ecclesiastes, if you've been paying attention, like he keeps going back to the fear of God. And you're like, I don't understand. Like, fear is a really, really bad thing. I hate being scared. Why do you feel like you need to know the answer? Because you're scared. Why do I? Like, let me be very transparent here. Why do I feel like I need to know the answers of the past? Why do I feel, what is driving the felt gut anxiety, pressure, fear? I got to know what to do right now. And I got to know what's going to happen in the future. Like, there's nut stuff happening in this world. And I've got to know what to do. And I got to know how to protect my family. And I got to know how to vote. And I got to know what theological, and I got to know, and I got, why? Fear. You're afraid. I'm afraid. Right? The thing that is driving the emotional turmoil and the reason we feel like we need to know the answer at the end of it, at the root of it, it's fear. And the answer that the author of Ecclesiastes is building to is he is saying the right fear of God places all of our fears in the proper place. An awareness that there is someone more powerful, beyond my control, beyond my wisdom or understanding, that is actually present, and he is sovereign and he is near. I need that. I would need that. And you're like, I don't want to be scared of God. I don't like the idea of a God that I'm afraid of, that I fear. I once went hiking with a buddy on the Appalachian Trail, and we came to this cliff. And you walk out onto the rock face, and it's gorgeous. And if you also walk out onto the rock face, and there's a degree of fear. Not because the rock face is malicious, not because the cliff is out to get me, but because the cliff is bigger than me, and I'm at the end of my control. It is transcendent to me, and it is right and good. And any other emotion, when you are standing on the edge of a cliff, any emotion other than fear is misplaced and potentially destructive. To give you another example, I don't do a lot of super masculine things. One thing that I love to do, it's very therapeutic, is to split wood. And it's just this very violent experience. My kids love to watch because it's metal on wood, and it's just, and it just shatters, and it's very, and my kids were all watching last fall, and man, it's great. And it's like the one time where my kids are like, "Daddy, you're real strong." And you're like, "Yes, I am. We need to do this more often." Splitting wood for my gas-lit fireplace. And yeah, first world. And so, because who has time to really start a fire, right? A few weeks later, one of my kids, they were real scared. Something happened. They're in the room. And they're just real nervous. The monster. And I got down. And I took their little hand. I put it in mine. I'm like, "Hey, remember when we were splitting wood?" Who's bigger, Daddy or the monster? I'm going to give you a hint. Daddy can't fit under your bed. And they're like, there is a peace that only can be found in bringing to mind the one who is bigger, stronger, beyond my control. I can't stop him, but he loves me and he is near to me. And he is for me. Puts all of the other fears that we have, because the world is a scary place. But without God, you got to figure out the answer. With God, we still try to figure it out. But in the moments where you don't, he is there. You're not alone. The Father whom we fear, who is near and steadfastly passionate about his children. He is in the tomorrow. That conversation that you had yesterday, he was in that. The thing that your mind is roiling over right now, he's there. He knows how it will resolve. And so at the end of the day, we take our stuff. The stuff that really matters, like the stuff that's in our gut that we can't figure out. We hold it with open hands and we say, "Lord, I need you here." The righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hands of God. I invite you, I would encourage you, bow your heads. I'm going to invite the band up. When I was preparing, when I was thinking this through, in our Bible reading plan for the year, we were in Romans. And in this moment of quiet, this is what I would like you to do, is to picture the problem that you can't unravel. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine, nakedness, danger, or sword?
As it is written, for your sake, we're being killed all the day long. We're regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. And what Paul here is processing, he says, Lord, we're really vulnerable. We feel vulnerable and we feel on the edge of a cliff is where your path seems to take us. And he says this, knowing all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, politicians or generals, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Father, I lift up my brothers and my sisters. Who feel the weight, who care about their path and are overwhelmed by the crookedness of it. Lord, may we be a people. May my brothers and sisters be met by you right here. You're bigger than our stuff. You're bigger than the strife and the angst in our hearts. You're bigger than our anxieties. And you have not asked us to figure it out. You haven't required that as a precedent for your love and affection. You are here present with us. And Lord, may we be a people, sons and daughters, who rest in confidence that our Father is big. And he holds us. May we find rest and peace there. And in Jesus' name we pray and trust. Amen.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.